Thank you, Lisa. I'd like to thank the organizers very much for the opportunity to talk here at this very interesting and diverse meeting. I'd like to put in one more plug. You've already had a pitch from Patrick and Simon about the Royal Society workshop that's taking place next February, the 23rd and 24th. It's a Thursday and a Friday, so you can then spend the weekend in London going to the theatre or whatever. It'll be a lovely mix of mathematicians, chemists, engineers, and in a beautiful environment, as Patrick told us, with gardens to wander in and develop high thoughts in. This picture here comes from one of the speakers. It's a sort of part two of one that Simon gave. This is an image of sodalite, which I'm rather attached to. That's kind of a bit larger than unit cell. And Mike Treacy can create these strange perspective pictures from within the crystal. So please visit the website, even if you're uncertain about whether you're going to come along to that meeting. So let me start with just an outline of what I want to talk about. And I'm going to keep this quite gentle. It's early in the morning, and I'm not going to be too ambitious here. My target is to talk about the rigidity matrix. I think it's almost appeared, but not quite. The rigidity matrix that's associated with the flexes of periodic frameworks, the flexes which are sort of periodic modulo and affine impetus or background affine distribution of velocities. So Wassier and Strenu bring that out in their paper of Royal Society, which has been mentioned. And their approach is very quick, neat and direct. It involves looking at semi-projective algebraic varieties because they're concerned somewhat with the entire deformation space. And I wanted to understand this better, and so I've been looking at a kind of more direct way of approaching this matrix, one which starts from an infinite rigidity matrix, which is something that I like to think about, starting with the infinite thing, which is actually rather simple-minded. It's the same definition as the usual rigidity matrix, but nevertheless one can then restrict it to certain spaces of flexes or displacements and go into a context that one's really interested in and then bring into play the formalism that sort of crystallizes there. So there's a sort of line of direction here. What I wanted to do was obtain a variant of the Maxwell-Calladine formula. We've heard about that in various ways, in this context, which takes into account symmetry. So it's a symmetry-adapted counting formula in the style of Patrick and Simon. So I'm not going to be counting too much and getting too much into applications. I'm sort of a little bit more up there with the sort of theoretical background. There's somebody here with a shirt the other day which said on the back, "Oh, but what does it mean in theory?" So maybe I'm slightly from that direction. So the, as we all know, the Maxwell-Calladine formula says the following: if you have a finite framework in three dimensions, say, then framework has mod V vertices and mod E edges, then the dimension of the space of two flexes, mechanisms, of the framework minus the dimension of the self space of self-stresses is given by this number here, with six recording, this is in 3D, the number of trivial infinitesimal flexes, including rotations and infinitesimal translations. So that 6 is also a dimension of a vector space. It's quite easy to prove this theorem. I mean, here's the rigidity matrix shape. And you know what the entries are. But then you take a linear vector space perspective and think to yourself, well, let's make a basis for the domain, ending up with a basis for all the infinitesimal flexes. So that would correspond to a subspace of the domain space, and when you multiply that matrix against that subspace, you'll always get zero. So there'll be a big zero in the matrix if you organize your basis in that fashion. And likewise, a self-stress is something in the co-null space of this matrix. So you can imagine in the vector space, whose basis is labeled by the edges, that you identify the a new basis whereby you take a basis for the self-stresses. So we'll put the self-stresses in here. We'll probably just call them stresses. And there will be a zero in here. And my diagram's not very good because what's left should be square. So row rank is equal to column rank. So we have a square thing here. And this tells us that this number is equal to this number. And when you rearrange what that's saying, it gives you the Maxwell-Calladine formula up here. So this would be, I guess, M plus the freedoms here. And this would be S for the dimension of the self-stresses. So some years back when I was visiting John and first getting interested in infinite frameworks, I mean, I've been looking at some papers of Simon from his website. I was fascinated by this formula that Patrick and Simon had for this expression of equalities between characters of representations. It's basically a symmetry adapted version of this counting formula. And we finally came up with a proof of this formula, which seemed in some ways very natural, and it made use of an essential symmetry property of the rigidity matrix. So it's this scheme that I want to apply to the Bossier-Strenu rigidity matrix. So let me just make note of what the symmetry equation is in this case. So I'm imagining G to be an element of the abstract group, let's just say symmetries. Then there's a simple permutation representation, so called rho E for edges, which changes around the basis element for the codomain labeled by the edges. So our symmetry acting on the framework will move the edges around, and so we have a permutation representation of the symmetry on that space. And over on this side, you have something somewhat more complicated. You have the permutation representation that goes with the vertices, and mixed in there is also the spatial representation on R3 that goes with the symmetry. So this is a certain thing that you have to kind of extract out of the formalism in the original proof. So that's a symmetry equation, and what's going on there is that you could go back to this picture, but think to yourself, I must be very careful when I start to specify a basis, that you have the symmetry element and it's acting on the domain and the range in such a manner that it leaves the Ridge-G matrix invariant. So with this equation you can see that if you have a, for example, if you have a flex which makes this zero, it makes this zero, so over here our transform of the flex is also a flex, sort of various obvious things are built into the formulas. So the strategy is to try and just use this approach to come up with a symmetry adapted version of the Maxwell-Calladine formula in the context of these affinely periodic infinitesimal flexes that Cyprian was and others have been talking about. So, some examples just to introduce the formalism, an old favorite, finite part of it. Here are some other examples. There's a 3D version of the Kagome framework, which is rather nice, where you take a parallelepiped, and in one corner you have the tetrahedron, and if you slice through any plane on the side of this parallelepiped, you're seeing the Kagome framework. So it's a sort of 3D version of the Kagome framework. So that's, I think, associated with beta cristobalite, one of these minerals. I think it's included, in fact, in Cyprian's talk. Sodalite, the picture I started with, and the way I like to think of sodalite is it's a, you have this four ring sitting on the midpoints of a square, and there'll be, I guess, five other four rings on the other faces of that square, and that assembles what's called the sodalite cage, which is a bit bigger, or twice as big, in fact, as the unit cell. And then if you wander into the database of natural zeolites, you can find many other more frameworks in addition to the ones that were mentioned yesterday. Perhaps the most dramatic, I think I've got it here somewhere, is Paulingite, which when you look at the picture of it, unit cell, or perhaps it's a bit bigger than unit cell, has this structure. Now here, just to sort of orientate you a little bit about the conventions here. Here each corner point, vertex point, is actually a silicon atom. Cyprian mentioned this yesterday. So it's a bit of a mismatch here between these pictures and the bar joint pictures that we really like. But within this structure, you can see, well, tiling is a topic. And I think at the Royal Society meeting, there'll be a few of these experts on these tilings of three space. Tiling is a topic, and regular geometry is a topic, and it's a really fascinating area. And what's also fascinating is I've found, as I've been sort of browsing some of these crystallography papers, is the difference in cultures between the applied scientists and the mathematicians, and the way that they can just really take these structures and either in the lab or in simulation, just find out how many vibrational modes there are, and they give you a number. I think with this it's 36 local modes, you know. So there should be a way of deducing that mathematically. So I think the two cultures can really interact, well, it's an old point, interact favorably in this this direction. So that's Paulingite, a particular zeolite mineral. Well, my interest in these topics, I'll perhaps come back to it at the very end of the talk, is to do with a slightly different topic, to do with flexes which are periodic modulo phase. And this is what Martin Dove and some other scientists look at. They're measuring the low energy phonon modes of these crystals. And these correspond to infinitesimal flexes in a way which is quite quite precise. So one can prove that sodalite has a particular type of local infinitesimal flex, and from this one can predict that there will indeed be low energy phonons with arbitrary wave vector. Now here, on the other hand, is a more mathematical example. This is just purely invented. I was talking to Patrick about whether there might be some physical manifestation of this. I'm not sure yet, but maybe boron's in there somewhere. So this is just pure fancy. This is a tower, first of all, made out of regular hexahedra, two tetrahedra glued together, if you like. And they come in threes there as we go up. And they're in fact just three essential or additional degrees of freedom, other than spatial, that go with this. It's a bit like these tongs that you get. If you do a little flex of the bottom, that turns the entire behavior above. And either it's going to flex in an affine manner, if you maintain the symmetry, or it zips around wildly and becomes banded after an instant. So it's not surprising, because of that behavior, the constrictions here, that the hexahedron crystal structure going off in all directions is indeformable in any sense whatsoever. So that's a mathematical example, and one can come up with other invented examples coming from tilings in order to test out certain theories and formulae. Now, the nice thing about concentrating on frameworks and specific questions is that we can leave behind the problem of realizability, and can leave behind combinatorics. So what I like to start with when I'm thinking about these crystal frameworks is a geometric thing, namely the motif. So if I was thinking about the unit cell of the Kagome, I might have this picture in mind, but it's better to, just at the outset, pick on a representatives for the translation cosets of vertices. That would be those three vertices. That's my finite set of vertices, FV. Pick on a finite set of edges with the obvious property that the translates under the chosen periodicity structure of these fills out the whole crystallographic framework. So I'm just borrowing a term from crystallography that I'm calling this the motif that goes with the crystal framework and the translation group, the chosen period vectors. And there's a certain arbitrariness here about how you choose the edges and the vertices. I think Louis Theran was referred to a choice whereby these edges would be incident to at least one vertex in the chosen set. So this is somewhat analogous to the colored graph in a way which I'll mention in a minute, but it's got lengths, it's got all we need to make the various matrices. So here's a formal definition. I think you all know what's going on at the moment, but here's a formal definition of a crystal framework. It'll be a countable bar joint framework, GP, just an infinite version, countably infinite version of the usual bar joint framework, with a periodic labeling. We don't really need the vertices, just a periodic labeling of the framework points, where the first label, kappa, runs through, as it were, the unit cell, and the second label, K, comes from the translation group. It's perhaps a triple of integers. And so I have a finite set of vertices for my motif of vertices, and a finite set of edges for the framework edges, and this is just saying that the translates fill out the whole of the framework. So that's a formal mathematical definition, but I should add in that I'm assuming a full rank translation group. So these period vectors really go off in different directions. This isn't flattened into a plane, which would give you perhaps a not a discrete structure. So there's certain simplifications with that view. So we all know what this is. It's an infinitesimal flex. The picture's not very good, but the projection of this applied velocity, instantaneous velocity, is supposed to be the same as the projection onto this line of that applied velocity. So to first order, there's no change in edge length. And the miracle of an infinitesimal flex of an infinite structure is that this all happens at every edge for an assignment of these velocities. So the notation will be U kappa k for the velocity that's assigned to the vertex at kappa k. And the edge is just written like mathematical edges in terms of square brackets. So there's nothing really new here in this slide, but I want to emphasize the usefulness of thinking about the rigidity matrix of the entire bar joint framework. So this is an infinite matrix. There'll be a convention about how to write it down and where the columns and rows might go, but nevertheless there's nothing subtle about it at all. But it's helpful also to think of it as a linear transformation. Now, the domain space, well, why not take it to be as large as it possibly could be? Because this matrix is sparse, with only a finite number of non-zero entries in each row and each column, you can apply it by matrix multiplication to an arbitrary sequence of velocities. So this is a product vector space. No problem dealing with that. But and similarly, the codomain will be a product of R over the edges. So that's a rigidity matrix, which is infinite. It's got the same definition. And it's also a linear transformation between these two sort of large environments. So I like to think of this rigidity matrix as a kind of a mother of all, well, almost all other rigidity matrices. So one can use it, restrict to a certain subspace of flexes, as I'll do in a minute, to come up with the rigidity matrix. First of all, the strictly periodic rigidity matrix, which is in the background of what Alyssa was talking about, I would call that the motive rigidity matrix. When one introduces affine periodicity, then the matrix gets larger. So there's an extra bit coming in here. There are more columns. And then there are other matrices that go with phase periodic infinitesimal flexes, which are related to these rigid unit modes. So here's one way of thinking about these affinely periodic infinitesimal flexes. Just define them outright. And one has to take care of the period vectors in some way or other. This matrix A, you can think of it as changing the lattice. So it's a matrix which is telling you how your three orthogonal coordinates are being shifted. It's a kind of velocity attached to each the end of each unit vector, which sends the lattice into a movement. So that lattice gives an impetus to anything lying in space. Far out, that impetus is going to be great. And near the unit cell, that impetus won't be so much. So that's A times K if we had an orthogonal cubic structure. If we have period vectors, then we'd have to introduce this extra bit of data. But basically, an infinitesimal flex is coming from this tuple here. As Justin was saying, you have a velocities applied in the unit cell, and then you have this matrix, which is giving you the affine motion for free, as it were. So that's an affine periodic velocity vector written in here, given by this pair. And it's, of course, it's going to be an affinely periodic infinitesimal flex if it's in the kernel of the infinite rigidity matrix. So that's a definition which complies with what we think about, but there are other ways of formulating the definition. Just to make a little bit of contact with continuous flexes, one could think of the following. You imagine you have a deformation happening, then in the first instant you should be getting an infinitesimal flex. That deformation can be changing the lattice. This is typically what's happening with these phase transitions. So here's the translation vectors or isometries that are given at the outset, and we have this affine flow which is telling us how we're pushing the axes around. And in that circumstance, we'd want this kind of periodicity to be preserved. So that's just recording what we think of when we're talking about it's a flex, which is periodic modulo this affine movement. Of course, the distance conditions have also got to hold. Then if you set that up, then the derivative is indeed an affinely periodic infinitesimal flex of the type I was saying, and indeed so you have that connection. And in fact, because you're only talking about the first instant, you may as well throw away that lovely flow you had at the beginning and just go in one particular direction, a linear direction. So this is how you could make a third definition, which is about distance changes being of second order. So we start off with this matrix A, that's in the data for the flex that Justin was mentioning, make this affine flow, which is just a continuous map of non-singular transformations. Then this condition here, you don't have to read it, is just saying that the distance changes are of higher order as t goes to zero. So you can fit together these different perspectives, but the one I like to think about is this somewhat linearized definition. So here is the rigidity matrix that a number of people have been working with and developing in different ways. Walter and Elissa and Bernd have done a lot of work on this, in particular looking at restricted variants, where you restrict some aspect of the affine motion, which perhaps reflects some of the symmetry that's already evident in the periodic framework. So here's a finite matrix being defined. I like to use the notation Rm Rd squared. So the structure of this matrix is that you have the strictly periodic rigidity matrix coming from the motif data in the first part, and then you've got these extra columns. So these extra columns allow you to make the kernel, as it were, of the null space bigger, because we're now inputting these pairs, U matrix. So U gets hit by the periodic rigidity matrix. Might not be zero anymore, but X times A thought of as a big long row vector, compensates for that non-zero, and you do get a flex. So quite how you construct it, well, it's completely formulaic from the motif. You need at some point to think about how you're going to talk of going from the edges that go from one cell to another cell, and one could just make a definition of exponent of the edge as being the sort of endpoint cell that you go to. So this is the definition exactly as in Bossio and Strenu's paper, although they come at it from a different angle. We can get it with the following observation. So if you just restrict the rigidity matrix transformation that I was mentioning before, decide to call the domain vector space, this huge vector space H sub V, and the range vector space H sub E. If you restrict it to the finite dimensional space of affinely periodic infinitesimal displacements, then you can work out its representing matrix. So this is linear algebra. and the representing matrix is the Bossier-Strenu matrix. Of course, it would have to be. But you can actually construct it. Then there's an equivalence that my pair is in the null space of this matrix. That's equivalent to my big. So that pair is code for the actual infinitesimal flex across the entire framework. That's equivalent to this being in the kernel. So one can get various corollaries in this manner, such as the condition for the framework being affinely periodically rigid. But now things are set up here with, at least to me, with a certain clarity, where the linear aspect is imposed, that we can now add in the symmetry and capture what's going on there. So how should we capture the symmetry of the framework in this context? So let's just think of the crystallographic group as an abstract group, because we're going to make it do lots of different things. And first of all, so this is the space group that I'm thinking about, of all isometric symmetries of the periodic framework, including translations and glide reflections and so on. Well, first of all, it acts by permutation of the vertex labels. So we might introduce a simple notation for that, G dot kappa k. It acts on the edge labels, might write it like that, and there's an induced kind of coset action on the motif set, so kappa k goes to tau kappa dash, so let's just call that tau g dot k. And this last one is just acting on the motif vertices, gives a linear representation of the infinite space group as finite dimensional transformations of this vector space. And again, this is just permutation, so I don't have d times the number of vertices in the motif, it's just uninflated at this point. Now it connects together, of course, the spatial representation of the crystallographic group takes us to translations and to affine isometries, the whole works, but it's operating in RD, and of course we have this connection between the two. Really, if you like, it's a definition of G dot kappa k. Then, just as John and I showed for the case of finite matrices some time back, that you have this symmetry equation. You have, it's the same proof essentially, you have this symmetry equation relating two representations of the crystallographic group, the edge representation, which is permutation type, as before, and the representation in the domain, which is somewhat more complicated. So these components here, rho E and rho V, are natural linear transformation representations of the crystallographic group. That might look a bit odd, but we've just expanded out the domain here and represented a space group transformation partly as a shift of coordinates in this big vector space. So this equation allows in sort of various perspectives. One can start thinking about sort of group representation methods, and one can start restricting to certain invariant subspaces. That's a subspace of displacement vectors which is left invariant when you act on it by the rigidity matrix. And the space of affinely periodic flexes has exactly that property. So the symmetry equation for the Poisson-Strenier matrix in this case, when you sort of quotient out or restrict to what it's actually saying, looks like this, that there's a symmetry equation where pi e represents the crystallographic group on the finite dimensional vector space coming from the edges in the motif. Pi v is a similar representation, but on the vector space coming from the vertices of the motif, fattened out by the coordinates as well. And of course, it has to also be acting on the extra columns. It has to be acting on the matrix that goes with an affine displacement velocity. So how does it do that? Well, the typical domain vector for the rigidity matrix is written as a pair, UA, where the matrix A is written out with its columns one after the other. So you've got a big, long d squared length row. The action on this pair is given by this formula, where you still have some spatial action going on within the unit cell, and you have this transformation of the affine impetus matrix. So that just falls out of the formalism, but then one can make use of it. This is a representation, mu. So what's going on here is that, first of all, did I skip over this? Tg is affine here, that's right. And rho g is infinite. So then, in the next slide, pi g, pi e of g, is rho e of g, and then it's restricted down to this finite dimensional space of periodic, infinitesimal, so periodic self-stresses. So I guess it's e, periodic self-stresses, and pi v of g is rho, well, I could write like this, rho v tensor, rho spatial, acting on g, restricted to the affinely periodic displacement vectors in this coded form, u comma a. So this... Yeah, I mean, this is true. This one thing that one makes use of is that for the rigidity matrix, the affine part of the transformation is irrelevant. So we have this so you could be right. It may be that I have to ignore or enlarge the definition of this point. So, of course, that's not a problem if we restrict to the space of matrices that are fixed by the symmetry under consideration. So, I guess there's an intermediate step here that in the separable case, one can just take restriction of elements in the space group which are coming from the point group. So when we have this particular structure, there is a immediate transfer to the point group from the previous formalism. The general non-separable case, I think the representation on the domain space does not easily restrict to a representation of the point group here. Now I'm thinking of the quotient of the crystallographic group by the translation group, which is a kind of generalized point group. Nevertheless, for individual symmetries such as these glide symmetries, one can obtain the symmetry equation where we restrict the rigidity matrix to those infinitesimal affine periodic flexes which respect the symmetry. So here there's no conjugation action because the flex matrix A is fixed, commutes with the TG. So the issue you mentioned before about the interpretation doesn't arise, in fact, in this symmetry-respecting case. So going on to this particular example, the hexahedron framework, I just know a little bit about this thing, but I wondered whether it would be a finely periodic rigid, as well as being rigid in other senses. Well, first of all, there are no non-trivial periodic infinitesimal flexes. That's fairly straightforward to work out from the rigidity matrix for this framework, the periodic rigidity matrix. So the symmetry equation leads to something that I just put on the board but didn't really talk about, this formula. So if I have an element of the space group G which induces an element of the quotient group, which I'm going to call the point group, call that sigma, then the dimension of the space of sigma symmetric mechanisms minus the space of sigma symmetric self-stresses, this needs a little bit of discussion what's going on there, one can define it simple-mindedly simply as the dimension of the co-null space of the BS matrix. Well, that doesn't really tell you, that definition, what's going on there. An engineer would have to point out what's happening in a more intuitive way. Somehow, the way to think about it is you have these self-stresses before you allow any affine motion, but if you allow affine motion, those self-stresses don't count anymore, because in fact the kind of affine motion is releasing it. You know, that's how I kind of foggily think about this number here, in a way other than the cold definition. Then this, as Byrne was saying when he was talking about the orbit matrix, this set of cosets under the symmetry of the vertices and the edges in the motif, that corresponds to the size of the orbit rigidity matrix. And this F sigma, the one that you have to think about carefully, that's the number of freedoms for affine motions which respect the symmetry. And there's this extra ingredient here, which is just the dimension of the matrices which commute or which are fixed by the symmetry isometry. So that's the kind of full-blooded form of the Maxwell-Calladine equation, and one can gain from it this useful flexibility predictor that Walter and Berndt and Elissa made use of, which again, I guess, is the inequality comes from saying that M is greater than this lot. So for the hexahedron, one can apply this thing to the hexahedron grid. I mean, these zeolites have huge rigidity matrices, so having these rules of thumb is extremely useful. With the hexahedron framework, one can do it by hand almost, but still it's good to have these shortcut rule of thumb. So one can see, in the manner I was talking before, there are no non-trivial continuous finite deformations, but nevertheless there is an affinely periodic infinitesimal flex, which in fact respects the mirror symmetry in the XY plane. So it wants to do that kind of motion that gets stuck immediately, but nevertheless there's an infinitesimal motion that exists. So I thought I'd just spend a couple of moments mentioning again the kind of philosophy that it's useful to consider the infinite rigidity matrix in various ways and restrict down to a particular context, because with this matrix there's a nice simple connection with the infinite crystallographic group representations. And what I've been talking about is how to get down to the Bossier-Strenu matrix. Has this sort of form. Now, the other way in which this infinite matrix perspective is useful is in connection with what are called rigid unit modes, or RUMs. And these are kind of generalizations of infinitesimal flexes which are periodic for a supercell period. So Renouille was talking yesterday about the periodic flexes. He was restricting himself to periodic modulo the lattice cells. But if you go to a supercell, then you get more flexibility for your period. And that corresponds to your infinitesimal flex, corresponds to that velocity distribution being periodic modulo a certain rational phase, or the phase factor is actually takes part in three coordinates. So if I had something like e to the 2 pi over 8, maybe this corresponds to eightfold periodicity. And what the mineral scientists do is they try to find all these modes of vibrations, not just the supercell periodic ones which correspond to rational points, but all phases for these periodic modulo phase infinitesimal flexes. And if you pick a particular phase, you get a variant of the motif rigidity matrix, which for a particular phase omega I like to write like this, because when you consider all the phases, you have here, in fact, a sampling of a matrix function whose entries are basically monomials corresponding to the exponents in the motif. So there's just trying to promote the view again of thinking about the infinite rigidity matrix, that the the motif in the case of the RUM perspective leads to a matrix with a parameter in it, the parameters being these phases or possible phases. And in the case of these zeolites where there's Maxwell counting equilibrium, the degeneracies occur when the determinant of this matrix function, which will be square in that case, is zero. So you get the idea that the RUM spectrum is equal to an algebraic variety, which I don't think the material scientists need to take note of or worry about. Why should they, perhaps? But nevertheless, the Rom spectrum will be coming from the determinant of this matrix. So there's a particular polynomial which is brought into play by this perspective. And I'll stop there. Thank you.